Bibles to Matthew 27. As Josh mentioned a few minutes ago, we're going to focus on the cross in our service today, as we've already been doing. You know, many churches have a Good Friday service, and that hasn't been a part of our tradition, so we've started a new tradition. I don't know if you've noticed it or not, but for the past few years, the week before Easter, I've done a sermon about the cross, because I felt through the years we were trying to cover Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection all on Easter, and I think there is a very human tendency to speed through Friday to get to Sunday. Certainly resurrection was a central focus of those first followers of Jesus and of the New Testament church. But the cross also is right there at the center, at the heart of the gospel. The cross isn't pleasant. The cross isn't pretty. But it really tells us a lot about who God is. In Matthew 27, I'm going to start reading in verse 27. Then the governor's soldiers took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole company of soldiers around him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him, and then twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on his head. They put a staff in his right hand and knelt in front of him and mocked him. "Hail, King of the Jews," they said. They spit on him and took the staff and struck him on the head again and again. After they had mocked him, they took off the robe and put his own clothes back on him. Then they led him away to crucify him. As they were going out, they met a man from Cyrene named Simon, and they forced him to carry the cross. They came to a place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. There they offered Jesus wine to drink mixed with gall, but after tasting it, he refused to drink it. When they had crucified him, they divided up his clothes by casting lots. And sitting down, they kept watch over him there. Above his head, they placed the written charge against him: "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." The two robbers were crucified with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come down from the cross if you are the Son of God." In the same way, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders mocked him. "He saved others," they said, "but he can't save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down from the cross and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he wants him. For he said, 'I'm the Son of God.'" In the same way, the robbers who were crucified with him also heaped insults on him. We see at this point, when Jesus had finally been turned over to the Roman guards, that Jesus was exposed in every sense of the word. One of the things they did is that they stripped him, which was normal procedure in a crucifixion. It says they stripped him and they put a scarlet robe on him to mock him. Later on it says they put his own clothes back on him, but that was just temporary, because when they took him to crucify him, it says they cast lots, but they sold his clothes by casting lots. Jesus was physically exposed by being stripped naked before the crowd. He's also exposed in the sense that he was vulnerable to a whole company of soldiers beating one man. He was also exposed to mocking and to insult, to spitting, to an event that was designed to be as painful and as humiliating as humanly possible. But as Jesus surrendered himself to go to the cross, and he was exposed in all those ways, the event of the cross exposed some other things that I want to first one is that the cross exposes how far the enemy was willing to go. Now, as I've thought about crucifixion, as I've pictured what happened on the cross for me and for us, that most of the images that I have in my mind have come largely from culture or from art history and that kind of thing, because the Bible doesn't really say a whole lot about it. It doesn't give much detail. But we know a lot about it from ancient accounts and from history, the history of the Roman Empire. And we know from these accounts that it was designed really to be a deterrent to anyone else besides the victim who was being crucified. Crucifixion was designed to be a deterrent to anybody who was thinking about defying the Roman Empire. They wanted to send a strong message, a message in the strongest way possible. This is what happens to somebody who challenges the status quo. If you don't want to end up like this person, be a good citizen and do what you're told. In Jerusalem today, there are two locations where it's said that Jesus was crucified. One is the Catholic, the traditional Catholic place, and the other is the traditional Protestant place. Where they say this is where it happened. But both of them are just outside one of the ancient city gates that was there. And that's where the Romans would do their executions. And that was so that as many people as possible would see what was going on. It also just so happens that both of these locations are at the site of abandoned rock quarries. They're places where rock was being quarried to build the walls of Jerusalem. And they would quarry rock for a while, but they got to a point where if you can imagine, a hill of stone, and the face of it is being cut away, but they get to a point that there are cracks in the rock to the point where it's no longer usable to quarry rock. So you've got this big face of stone that's been cut away from a hill, and right outside the city gate. So as you walk out the gate, you see this big mound of rock. And as it says in the text here, they came to a place, it was called the place of the skull, and which sounds pretty ominous, and it was ominous for what happened there. But the word is just head, the place of the head. It's this big mound of rock that looks kind of like a human head. And In paintings, I started thinking about, you know, my visions of what this must have looked like come from paintings of the cross. And usually what happened, the picture that I have in my mind from all the paintings that I've seen is the cross is done kind of in a remote place, kind of up on top of a hill, and so you're kind of far away from it, which kind of makes a dramatic picture in a painting. But really what's more likely is, you know, the scripture says they went to the hill. It didn't say they went up on the hill. It doesn't mean they couldn't have gone up on the hill, but it says they went to the place. What was more common for the Romans is they wanted to, for their crucifixions to be right in your face. Normally, it wasn't on a 12-foot cross. They were crucified with the victim's head about 5 feet off the ground. And not way far away up on a hill, but right at the front of the hill, right outside the gate, there's a backdrop of a big round piece of jagged rock. And then the cross is right there. Now, this took place at Passover. So Jerusalem would have been bustling. You know, righteous Jews from all over the known world would have come for the feast of the Passover. And people who were traveling would be needing to make their preparations for the Passover feast. So the markets would be bustling. I mean, it was probably crazy. It would have been like Publix on the Wednesday night before Thanksgiving. Or maybe even like the mall on Black Friday. You could probably hardly move. The city swelled to way beyond its normal population. It's a really busy place. And when the Romans crucified, again, the message was, don't let this happen to you. And they wanted people to see it up close. So it probably didn't happen far away. It's not like walking out of the mall and looking and something's going on up there on top of the mall. It's right there in the food court. So that when you walk by, you look face to face with the victim. So as Jesus was exposed physically, as he was exposed to the brutality of a beating from a whole company of soldiers, and to insults and mocking and spitting, one of the things that was exposed was the brutality of an authoritarian regime. The brutality of a culture that says, you do what I say or else. But of course, the Romans who actually carried out this execution didn't have a beef with Jesus personally. The crucifixion was a picture of how far they were willing to go to maintain control. But really, Jesus ended up there not because he challenged the status quo of the Roman Empire, per se, but he challenged the religious status quo. And as this event unfolded, it also showed how far Jesus' enemies were willing to go because he challenged the religious status quo of the time. Look in Matthew 27, starting in verse 15. Now it was the governor's custom at the feast to release a prisoner chosen by the crowd. At that time they had a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. So when the crowd had gathered, Pilate asked them, which one do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus who is called Christ? For he knew it was out of envy that they handed Jesus over to him. While Pilate was sitting on the judge's seat, his wife sent him this message, don't have anything to do with that innocent man, for I have suffered a great deal today in a dream because of him. But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and to have Jesus executed. Which of the two do you want me to release to you? Asked the governor. Barabbas, they answered. What shall I do then with Jesus, who is called Christ? Pilate asked. They all answered, crucify him. Why? What crime has he committed? Asked Pilate. But they shouted all the louder, crucify him. When Pilate saw that he was getting nowhere, but that instead an uproar was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd. I am innocent of this man's blood, he said. It is your responsibility. All the people answered, let his blood be on us and on our children. Let his blood be on us and on our children. Then he released Barabbas to them, but he had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. The cross exposes how far the enemy was willing to go. To the point of it was obvious that Jesus was being handed over out of envy. Earlier during the trial, it says they produced false witnesses. They couldn't even get their story straight, but it's how far they were willing to go because Jesus challenged the religious status quo. Pilate, the Roman governor, knew that he was innocent. But his enemies were willing to go so far as to say, we take full responsibility, let his blood be on our hands and the hands of our children. The cross also exposes the cost of my sin. And I think it's good, it's appropriate for every one of us to say it that way. Jesus died for the sin of the world, that's true. But the cross exposes the cost of my sin. Not just my sins and all the things that I've done wrong, but just my sin, my sinfulness. Isaiah says that sin separates us from God. But Jesus went to the cross because God is a God of relationship. God does not want to be separated from us. God exists as a relational God, Father, Son, and Spirit in an eternal relationship of self-giving love. But God's heart, God's desire is to include every one of us in that eternal relationship of self-giving love. And we see at the cross the cost of my sin. We've already referred to this today, but just listen to this passage from 1 Peter chapter 2. It's 22 through 25. He, that is Jesus, committed no sin, and no deceit was found in his mouth. When they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree so that we might die to sins and live for righteousness. By his wounds, you have been healed. For you were like sheep going astray, but now you have returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. The cross exposes the cost of my sin. Look back in Matthew 27, starting in verse 45. From the sixth hour until the ninth hour, darkness came over all the land. About the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? When some of those standing there heard this, they said, he's calling Elijah. Immediately, one of them ran and got a sponge. He filled it with wine vinegar, put it on a stick, and he offered it to Jesus to drink. The rest said, now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to save him. And when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook and the rocks split. The tombs broke open, and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs, and after Jesus' resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many people. When the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, "Surely this was the Son of God." We could go into a lot of detail about what happens to a person when they are flogged or crucified. And I don't believe that the physical torment of the cross can be understated. But I also don't believe that the physical torment of the cross was the ultimate cost for my sin and for yours. I believe it shows the brutality of this world. But I believe in a sense it's also a metaphor for the real pain of the cross, and that was, my God, why have you left me all alone? Now, I don't know about you, but I live my life longing for the experience of the presence of God. And it seems like every once in a while, God pulls back the curtain. And I get that. And just a glimpse is enough to keep me going for a long time. It's one thing to know intellectually that God is with you. But don't you want to feel that God is with you? Don't you want to sense that? But we know what it's like, especially in times of suffering. In times when everything seems upside down, things are going wrong, you don't know what's going on. Times of suffering or times of confusion, times of doubt. Times of struggle, times of loss. And you're crying out to God and you feel like you're screaming into the void and there is no answer. Many of us know what that's like. I believe Jesus didn't know what that was like until that moment. A part of his taking on flesh, becoming one of us, to reach out to us, to connect with us, was facing everything. All the temptation that we would have to face. And I believe finally on the cross, our separation from God, the cost of our sin, happened. And for the first time in his eternal existence, Jesus experienced our hell on earth, and that is, where is God when I'm suffering? Does God care that I'm suffering? Has God just turned his back? Again, not to downplay anything about the physical torment of the cross, but I believe that was the cost. Ultimately, that was the cost of my sin and your sin. But then also, the cross exposes not only how far the enemy was willing to go and the cost of my sin, but the cross exposes how far God was willing to go. As I've already talked about, Easter weekend, as we call it, this event of crucifixion took place at Passover. And the whole Passover feast was based on a scripture in Exodus chapter 6. If you want to turn there, you can. Exodus 6, verses 6 and 7. God tells Moses what to do to remember their rescue from slavery in Egypt and how to celebrate the Passover. He says, therefore, say to the Israelites, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with mighty acts of judgment. I will take you as my own people, and I will be your God. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God who brought you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. Just less than 2 days before, Jesus had told his disciples to make preparation for the Passover meal. So they went into town and they met in this upper room. And they were going to celebrate the Passover meal. And at that Passover meal, what they would have had in their minds was this passage from Exodus chapter 6. And in the Passover meal, as they focused on this Exodus 6 passage, there were 4 cups of wine that were served with the meal. And they each had very symbolic meaning. Again, the Exodus 6 passage says, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with mighty acts of judgment. I will take you as my own people. There are 4 phrases from that passage that went along with each of the 4 cups of wine. The first cup is, I will bring you out. As they poured the first cup of wine and shared it, the focus was on telling the children about how God brought them out. They wanted to never forget that the God they worshiped was the God who heard their cries when they were in slavery. And there was a script that they would follow. And traditionally, the script was set up by questions that were asked. Traditionally, it was the youngest child who were there that would ask. They would give them certain questions to ask. And the things they said were the responses to those children. And the most famous of which is, why is this night? Picture the youngest child around the table asking, why is this night different from any other night? And traditionally, the father would say, this night is different from any other night because we're remembering that we were slaves in Egypt. They didn't say our ancestors were slaves. He says, we were slaves. And we cried out to God, and God heard our cry. The first cup is, I will bring you out. The second cup is, I will free you from being slaves. That cup was served while the story was being told. And when they reached the point about the 10 plagues that God sent, the person telling the story would dip his finger in the cup of wine and would let one drop drip for each of the plagues as they talked about him. They would have this visual picture of what God had done. The third cup, which was served right after supper, the line from that passage that went with that third cup was, I will redeem you with an outstretched arm. Remembering God's mighty works for them, what God was willing to do in order to redeem them. Not only hearing their cry, coming down, sending Moses, sending the plagues, releasing them, but also parting the Red Sea, sending manna and quail, giving them water from a rock. All the things. God heard our cry. God rescued us. God provided for us. All those things would have been talked about as they focused on that line, I will redeem you with an outstretched arm. And then the fourth cup right at the end was the first phrase from verse 7, I will take you as my own people. Look over in Luke chapter 22. As Jesus had his disciples prepare for the Passover, he did some things that were very traditional, but he also did some things that were very new. In this setting, in what we call the Last Supper, they were actually celebrating Passover. But Jesus actually gave them a new Passover story. As he was preparing to go and become the Passover lamb. Luke 22, verses 19 and 20. As Jesus is gathered for the last time with the 12. It says, "And he took bread, gave thanks, and broke it. And he gave it to them, saying, 'This is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' In the same way, after the supper, he took the cup, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you.'" In the same way, after supper, he took the cup, saying, this cup, which cup? The one right after supper. That's cup number 3, the one that corresponds to the verse, "I will redeem you with an outstretched arm." It's the cup of redemption. Traditionally, they remembered all the things that God had done, what God was willing to do to redeem them and to rescue them. And I believe Jesus was saying, he says, he took this cup, the cup right after supper, cup number 3, and he says, "This cup now is the new covenant in my blood." I don't think the 12 even understood yet that Jesus was going to the cross, but Jesus knew it. And he says, "This cup and this new Passover story that I'm giving you now, and this new covenant I'm making with you, this cup, the third cup, the cup of redemption, is now the new covenant in my blood. Now I'm going to show you, with my body broken and my blood poured out, I'm going to show you how far God is willing to go." And so today, we're gathered here to remember the cross. And we remember so many different things. We can learn so many different things. We see in this one event how Jesus surrendered himself. And actually, as 1 Peter 2 says, he surrendered himself to God. He entrusted himself to the one who judges justly. But in the process of entrusting himself to God, he surrendered himself into the hands of sinful men. And by exposing himself, he exposed how far the enemy was willing to go. He exposed the cost of my sin and yours. But he exposed how far God was willing to go. And right now, we can take time to remember the cross. To remember Jesus' body broken and his blood poured out. And by doing this, we declare all that God has done. This cup is the cup of redemption. Israel remembered how God had said, I will rescue with an outstretched arm. Jesus said, now this cup is the new covenant in my blood. I'm about to go stretch out my arms to show you how far I'm willing to go for you. And that's what we remember this morning. Let's go to God in prayer.